Okay. Welcome back, everybody. We are officially on the other side of Rosh Hashanah. All we have to do is tackle the Yom Kippur Machzor and we'll be gold. So I'm just curious for just any reflections or thoughts about either things you noticed, things that struck you in a different way, experiences that were changed from being... I make no assumptions, by the way, if you were in Shul. If you didn't go to Shul, you're with the majority of Jews. But if you were, if you did encounter the Machzor, anything that came up for you, or yeah.
Well, a sort of solution to the conundrum of the the Musaf from Medina versus Avinu Malkeinu at Dorshei Congregation, Dorshei Tzedek in Newton, and actually Waltham, where they do the they use the Toich Machzor, which is the most complex book I have ever seen in my life, without a guide, a teacher's guide, you never negotiate. So they do the Mincha, they do the Musaf Kedusha in Shacharit, and then they do Machliyot, Zichronot, and Shofrot, and they do the first part of the Yomar through the Chatanos.
Okay, so now you see they're being true to Rabbi Akiva.
3.5 hours, what more can a person ask?
This is where if you speak to any other religion, they're like, 3.5 hours. Of, that's a good day. Oh boy, I'm sticking with this religion. Okay. Other reflections or experiences that you noticed?
The endless Amida seems shorter.
Structure gives some sort of roadmap to experiencing that. You're like. We've all played the game of flipping through the mocks, counting down the pages. That's a time-honored tradition, And you're like, oh, God. Oh, well, Kiyano Amecha is coming. Well, that's good. It's like in 13 pages. I can look forward to that. But now it's like, oh, I flip through and...
It's only 50 pages.
Right, exactly. But now I know what the 50 pages is. Yeah.
I kind of noticed that toward the end, like right after the Musaf Kedusha, people started trickling out, and it's because I don't think they have like enough knowledge about the amazingness of the liturgy to so really appreciate it and stick around.
Oh yeah, Kedusha is sort of like that. We're talking about Kedusha is like the high point, and Netanah Tokef leads into it, and then but the real meat of it is after the Kedusha, and so you sort of don't pay attention to that unless you're sort of aware of the structure. By the way, putting the Musaf Kedusha in Shacharit is something that is done on Yom Kippur everywhere. So not without precedent to move that longer Kedusha to Shacharit, but as we'll see in a few days. Yeah.
I was noticing and thinking about when people were sitting down for the Kedusha, because usually we say it, like in the repetition, we say it and sit down, but we hadn't yet said the blessing because we inserted the piyutim. So some people were sitting when we usually sit, and some people were waiting till the blessing.
Yes, I think we're at the same synagogue, so I have a machloka with the rabbi who says please be seated, when it's like, actually, you don't have to be seated, but there's a, you notice actually, right, we normally jam Kedusha, that standing prayer where we rise up like the angels, to be entirely overlapping with the third blessing, but here you can see that when you have Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri, if you remember way back to the first class, Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri says, oh, you have to put Malchiyot into the third blessing. You have all those Uvechein, right? Uvechein tein pachtecha, and all that stuff, which you might be seated for because it's not Kedusha, even though it's in the third blessing. But you might not be seated for because you might have the tradition to stand all the way through the third blessing. So your standing sitting is actually a commentary on where you think Kedusha ends. And that's part of what's being played out there. But if this is just minor trivia for you, then just note that the third blessing is much more complicated on Rosh Hashanah than it is on any other day, and that can get expressed in your body language. Okay, any other experiences? Yeah.
Yeah, I was davening in a shul where you davened obviously the Frida Sinat Chinam, and I thought there's a certain irony about it because it was a shul where Hadar is not permitted to daven, which I thought was Sinat Chinam, but then when I realized that Hadar pays rent there, it's really not even Sinat Chinam. Hadar is paying funds to be.
It's not Chinam. I would take, if people want to hate me freely, I would take the free hatred, but if I have to pay you to hate me, now.
I found it a little ironic.
Okay, so you spend much of the liturgy thinking about the immorality of the institution you were sitting in, which is a time-honored tradition in Jewish, you know, Jewish community. Okay, that's good. Yeah, no, yes, I hear you, but it could be worse. Okay, well, this is Rosh Hashanah.
In fact, yeah. Very worse, because the first night I went to my daughter's shul, and there they won't get right next to a small day school, which has no room, and they have enormous number of empty classrooms, and they won't allow them to pay to let kids learn Torah inside that building. And I said, you know, in a world of Sinat Chinam, one sector of the Jewish community seems to be monopolizing.
We will one day redistribute all the real estate as the way it's supposed to be, and everyone will be happier. Although not everybody, I guess. But anyways, okay. Rosh Hashanah, we have passed through that. And now we're heading to Yom Kippur. I have good news for you on Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur seems extremely complicated, but actually, structurally, is quite manageable. That's the good news, okay? So the bad news is it's longer than Rosh Hashanah. But the good news is, from a structure perspective, we can totally do this. And we're going to spend, as I mentioned when I outlined the class, we're going to be spending two sessions on sort of the main features of Yom Kippur. Today we're going to do Slichot, and on Wednesday we're going to do Vidui, which is Slichot, like Lislach is to forgive, so this is forgivenesses, let's say. Forgiveness, down. And Vidui is confession. And the goal of today is really to understand what is the Slichot service, which we are also doing in its own standalone version. We started already Saturday night before Rosh Hashanah, and we do it in the morning in many places now through Yom Kippur. But it is actually a major feature of the Machzor itself. And once you understand what Slichot is, then it's going to make a lot of the Yom Kippur liturgical experience clearer. And then a sort of a smaller percentage of the Machzor, but a very important part, is Vidui, is confession, which we'll look at more closely on Wednesday. Both of these are old traditions, although, like many traditions, there's old and then there's newer that's tacked onto it. So we're going to see the old and the new. I'm going to pass this out. Okay, we're going to look at what is the main part of Slichot, but before we do that, I just want to start at the end, because it's amazing, and if we don't do it now, we might not get to it. So turn to the last source. Just flip over to page 9. This source is a relatively recent source, Aruch HaShulchan, a little over 100 years ago, who is telling us that Slichot, we don't know what Slichot is yet, we haven't learned it, but whatever it is, the service of Slichot was said in all services on Yom Kippur. How many services are there on Yom Kippur, by the way?
Five.
Which are the normal three, morning, afternoon, evening, plus Ne'ilah, which is the additional service only said on Yom Kippur now, plus Musaf, which you have on every holiday. Okay? So five services, meaning five Amidas that you say during the 25 hours of Yom Kippur. Each of those services had Slichot connected with them. But Aruch HaShulchan says, what surprises me is that the Rosh at the end of Tractate Yoma and the Tur, these are big medieval halachic authorities, in this Siman, number 620, brought in the name of the Geonim to say in Shacharit five times, Vayavor Adonai al panav, and God passed. We'll see that's a critical part of what Slichot is, quote from Exodus. And some say it 13 times, corresponding to the 13 attributes, also a core part of what we're going to look at here. 13 attributes also from Exodus 34. And some say seven times, and in Musaf seven times, and also in Mincha. That is to say, there's a debate about how many times you should say it, but you're saying it in all the services. But we don't say this even once. That is to say, nowadays in most services, this is, again, dating back the last 150 years, in most services, Slichot on Yom Kippur is only said on Kol Nidre night and on Ne'ilah, okay? But there was a tradition to say it, an old tradition to say it in every service, okay? Including the morning service, the afternoon service, and the Musaf service. Why don't we say it? Now he has these great, great lines here that are coming up. There are customs that have no basis that people are very careful about. Read Kol Nidre, right? Kol Nidre, the lines of the formula of Kol Nidre, rabbis have hated it ever since they started. We're not going to look at it in depth, but it is basically a formula in which you undo all future vows that you're going to be coming up with next year. That's not, like if you're going into business, you know, oh, by the way, just check it out. The Jews, on one day a year, they undo all the vows that they're going to make during this year. So just think twice before you sign those deals with them. Rabbis were not happy about Kol Nidre, wanted to excise it as soon as it came up. Still there, still going strong. People can't stop the Kol Nidre runaway train. People are very careful about it. And this custom is from the Gaonim, that is, say, the authorities right after the Talmud, old, yet people aren't careful about it. This all came about because of the lengthening of the melodies to the point where there's no time to say Slichot. And saying the 13 attributes with Slichot is not possible. Even people tried to slim it down. Toich. Let's just get this down to the essence. It's one verse. Come on, we don't need a whole service around it. No, you can't do that. The great ones of the world already cried out against the Chazanim, but we don't have the power to protest against them. God should atone. Hashem Yechaper, right? It's like, what can I do? I can't actually fix this problem, but I'm just going to tell you that it is a problem. So let it be known that while you're singing away to Mari Cohen or whatever you're getting into, you should be saying Slichot, but you're not. But you're not alone. Okay. But you will be saying it on Kol Nidre night and Ne'ilah, which still are the most popular services for Yom Kippur. So it's worth examining. Yeah, please.
The one from the rabbi from where did it come from? Why is it stuck?
Kol Nidre?
Yeah.
Where did Kol Nidre come from if the rabbis hated it, and why did it stick? Yeah, it's a great question. So the short story on Kol Nidre is, the research on Kol Nidre was upended and made much more interesting when they found in Iraq, in Babylonia, magic bowls. Magic bowls are bowls, like a pottery bowl, that were turned upside down after having been written on and buried in the ground. And the purpose of these bowls were to defeat certain spirits that might be going after you, certain demons. So you would write on these bowls certain anti-demon phrases and bury them. What they found was when they dug up, there's hundreds of these bowls, a lot of them in the Bible Lands Museum in Israel. They found them, they date back to like 7th, 8th century. And by the way, those of you who use the Sokolov, the updated Jastrow, he learns a lot of Aramaic from the Aramaic bowls. You can actually, he indexes them in the back of his dictionary. Anyways, so what one theory on Kol Nidre is, it's a magic formula that came up through the people. It's sort of like folk religion, you know, where I'm going to, you know, it's like superstition, idea around what I'm going to say and what I don't mean to say. And this always a great giveaway is when you say things three times. Whenever you say things three times, you're in sort of magic world. Now, there's a big problem in study of religion of what's the difference between religion and magic, right? My religion is your magic and the reverse. So it's hard to really say, well, there was magic, that was Kol Nidre, that was the people, and the rabbis, the guardians of religion, they were anti-magic. It's hard to break it down that simple, but it was something that sort of like came up sort of grassroots, and when the rabbis got wind of it, they weren't too happy about it. I mean, they would be very happy for people not to take any vows at all, to make no promises whatsoever, never to take God's name in vain, as it were, because it's very hard to fulfill all your vows. But this was like another way to get around it. Anyways, that's the short story. If you're interested in it, I recommend this great book called, appropriately named, The High Holidays by Herman Kival. It just got reprinted, and he has a good chapter in there about Kol Nidre, the surprising history of Kol Nidre, I think is what it's called. It's printed separately, and also in that book. Okay, ready to go to Slichot? Ready to do it? Let's do it. Okay. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to get the main order of Slichot, and then we're going to look at the core texts of Slichot, okay? So on page one, I brought to you the main order of Slichot. And what you can see here is, it starts like all good services, except for Shacharit, with Ashrei, and it finishes with Tachanun and Kaddish Shalem. So those are sort of regular components of building blocks of any service. But what you'll see, the main element to slichot are what I underlined here. Forget chatzi kaddish, which is also underlined. Yud gimel midot. That's the 13 attributes, which we're going to look at in depth, which are the attributes of God that we say over and over again on Yom Kippur and on the slichot service. And then there are two types of introduction for those 13 attributes. One is called El Erech Hapayim, God of long patient ness, and El Melech Yoshev, God who sits on the God the King who sits on the. We'll see. Those are the two introductions, and it's sort of a repetition of the introduction plus the 13 attributes. That's the main thing of what Slichot is. Okay, so it's, you know, Adonai, Adonai, El Rachum, V'chanun, Erech Apai. That's the 13 attributes. And that's what you're going to say over and over again in any Slichot service, as we saw from the Aruch HaShulchan. You might say it 5 times, you might say it 7 times, 13 times, depending on how you want to correspond the numbers. But you're going to sort of over and over repeat that that recitation of that verse. And then where it gets long and complicated, like we saw in Rosh Hashanah, is when you add the poems. Okay? Adding in the poems is where things get longer. So you have basically a given unit of slichot is, you have the intro, El Melech Yoshev. Then you have the 13 attributes, which is relatively short. A couple other verses in there. And then you have a piyut, which is the poem, which is the longer thing, more stylized. And this little unit, if you multiply it by 5 times, 7 times, 13 times, depending on what you're going to be doing, now you're getting to page 1,244 in your Machzor, right? In other words, now we're getting some bulk to the Machzor, okay? But this is the basic building block of Slichot, which is what we're going to be doing on Kol Nidre night and Ne'ilah, okay? So just to bring it home, on Kol Nidre, what is the service? All you have, it's not surprising, okay? All you have is the formula of Kol Nidre. Don't be late. If it's called for 6 o'clock, show up at 5:45. Okay, word to the wise. You want to get that back seat. That's just one page. That's one page, okay? Then what do you have after Kol Nidre? The sermon. Okay, come on, people. All right? You have the sermon, or maybe the rabbi make you sit a little bit longer before the sermon comes out, but you're going to have some pause, and then you're basically going to launch into na 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 na, which is Maariv. Okay, your normal evening service with Shema, with the blessings before and after Shema, like any other evening service. It's exactly the same. And then you're going to get the Amidah. So far, it's exactly the same as any evening service. Shema and its blessings, plus Amidah. Now, you know that in the evening, we don't repeat the Amidah. Okay? So why, if I showed up at 5:45 for Kol Nidre, am I not going home till 8:30? Right? Because once you're done with the Amidah, which includes the confession, the Ashamnu and stuff, which we're going to look at on Wednesday, once you're done with the Amidah, then you enter immediately into Slichot. Basically, everything that happens in the Amidah on Kol Nidre night is the Slichot service. That's what it is. And that's the same thing with Ne'ilah, except that in Ne'ilah, you're actually repeating the Amidah and inserting Slichot into the middle of the Amidah. Okay? So whereas on Maariv, that is to say Kol Nidre night, that is to say Friday night, this coming Friday night, you're going to be saying just Slichot as what happens after the silent Amidah, if you stick around that long. And on Saturday night, when you're hungry, that's when you're going to be doing Slichot inside the middle of the Amidah for Ne'ilah. Okay? That's just what it is. And that's what makes Yom Kippur long. There are other reasons why Musaf gets long, which we'll touch on a little bit on Wednesday. Okay, any questions just about the structure of Slichot, where it falls, why Yom Kippur is extremely long, when the sermon happens? These are important things to know. Which seats are important? Yeah.
Subjectively, is it also just like, is the idea also to, because you're spending a day, or when the rabbi wants to spend a day in prayer completely, I'm wondering if that kind of came first, because if you were to say read or take a nap, then you're leaving, unless you're reading, you know, this is real and you're completely prepared or something like that. Like that you're leaving the mentality of the day for those few hours, and so therefore, like, let's keep you in the mood by forcing you to stand for
it. Make it longer, right, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think there's something aesthetic there. This gets to the age-old debate that is, say, in my head, of whether or not you should have a break on Yom Kippur. I used to be like, of course you have a break. When else are you going to take a nap or eat a snack, whatever? So so you want to be doing that. The longer the break, the better. But then I eventually went to services where the break, Drisha service, Alav HaShalom, always prided itself on not having of having a break of 5 minutes. You know, right? We're always saying, no, we'll come back in 5 minutes. But it's but it's like there's something to that, because once you're out of the zone, then you're, you know, it's hard to get back in. Like if you take that nap, you feel kind of gross, whatever. So anyways, yes, I think there's something to that. Although slichot exists as its own unit that's separate from just keeping you in shul. Meaning there, believe me, they could have come up with many ways to keep you in shul.
I was wondering if this was among the reasons.
Among them, yeah, potentially. They don't say there.
Could you just repeat where the slichot occurs in Ne'ilah again?
In Ne'ilah, it's going to be in the middle of the Amidah.
Okay, that's what I thought.
As opposed to on Kol Nidre, where it's after the Amidah. Because Kol Nidre, you don't repeat the Amidah, but Ne'ilah, you do. Ne'ilah is like any other Amidah, like morning, afternoon, Musaf, you're going to repeat the Amidah. Marv is the only time you don't.
It occurs in the repetition.
In the repetition of the Amidah in Ne'ilah. Right, exactly. Which in Ne'ilah, if you remember, that's they keep the ark open the entire time for the length of the Amidah repetition, which is why it's a standing prayer. Kol Nidre, you're also supposed to stand, but you're less hungry, so you don't notice it as much, and also they don't open the ark for the whole time. So there's that. Okay, let's get into the actual, the meat of the core parts. We're going to look at the introduction, and we're going to look at the 13 attributes and see why this is the critical building block here. Okay, so the introduction is rather short, and it's on the bottom of page 1 and goes to the top of page 2, just that box number 3. El Melech Yoshev Al Kisei Rachamim. What I'm going to ask you to do is just spend a couple minutes just to read it with your neighbor, and read it out loud, and see what you notice, ask questions, what jumps out at you. Again, just this one box number 3, on the bottom of page 1, top of page 2. This is the introduction to the 13 attributes, okay? Turn to a neighbor, read it out loud. We'll come back in 2-3 minutes. What jumped out at you at just looking at this little short piece, El Melech Yoshev, through the introduction to the 13 attributes? Yeah, got it.
One question that we had, I think, was that it says Hashem taught us to say the 13 attributes, which I think wasn't that Moshe saying it to Hashem in Shmot, when he was saying don't kill everybody for the pious thing. Am I mixing two things up?
You're mixing two things up, but you are correct also with the ambiguity. It's actually not around the spies, although we also get that in Slichot. It's the other sin, which is the golden calf.
Okay, the golden calf.
Yeah.
And then...
So your question is, wait a minute. God, at the top of page 2, it says, God, you taught us to say 13 attributes. And you're saying, well, wait a minute. Moses actually said the 13 attributes, at least when I read Exodus. So what do you mean that God did it? Okay, good.
And then it quotes a different verse.
And it quotes a different verse at the end.
To attribute the 13 attributes to a different verse than the one that Moshe said.
Good. Okay. The verse that's at the end is not the verse of the 13 attributes.
Yes.
Is that what you're saying?
I think so.
Right. It happens to be the one right before, but still.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Yeah. Good. It's like the introduction to the introduction of the verse. Okay. Good. But this is a core thing. And it's an ambiguity that has troubled people when they try to figure out what's going on with the 13 attributes. How does this play in? That we're going to explore in just a minute, because it is a core ambiguity that gives rise to why we are saying this and why we say that God taught us, as opposed to Moses said this to God or about God. Okay, other things that you noticed. Yeah, Yuki.
I have a question. This page 2. As you made known to your humble one of old.
Good.
What is this music?
Yes. The humble one of old. Yeah. Who is the humble one of old? Why of old? That is a good question. And you'll notice also the style here is this is a poetic style, because what the poets love to do is to take things that are clear and obfuscate them. So whereas I could have just said your name, I'm now going to say, instead of your name, like your nickname or your attribute. So who is the Anav person here? What's the Anav? Moshe is the Anav Mikol Adam. He's the most humble person. And as Gabi already pointed out, well, I know Moshe is involved somehow here. So this is a reference to Moshe, but not necessarily. Like another example of this is, do we say this in the third blessing after Shema? L'admat b'nei cham. Am I remembering that right? B'nei cham is like a good, not this, it's a synonym for Mitzrayim. But Mitzrayim was a child of Cham, Shem, Cham, and Yafet, the three kids of Noah. But Cham was the father of Canaan and like the father of all the evil nations. He was the one who didn't cover up Noah when he was drunk. So Mitzrayim is called B'nei Cham. So similarly, like Moshe is called Anav. And all these nicknames, Israel has like a bunch of poetic nicknames also, Yishurun or things like that. Okay, so why not just be clear about that? But anyways, that's, yes. Mary.
What about this phrase at the end of the second line from the bottom on page one? Says, to the quote, in kol basar v'ruach instead of basar v'dam.
Good. Kol basar v'ruach, all flesh and spirit as opposed to all flesh and blood. Is there some significance to that? And is it calling upon some other reference that you might, good, as opposed to what you might have expected of basar v'dam? Good. Okay, yeah. We're just getting things on the table here. Yeah.
This probably isn't unique to this, but it seemed very apparent that like the description of God that is used is like kind of the appropriate one for what we're trying to do here. It's like El Melech Yosheva Kisei Rachamim. Well, actually, like, you know, we could have, like, there's the whole like conversation about like Kisei Rachamim and Kisei Jildin, right?
Right.
You know, so it's like, okay, but like that's the one we're going to use here.
Right.
We're talking about Rachamim, we're talking about, you know, these are like the character traits we're trying to like evoke here.
Right.
Whereas, like, to contrast that with like Tzoken or something where it's like a much more varied picture.
Yeah, right. Where you had the Kisei Shelemet and Dean. By the way, Midnaheg b'chassidut, the second line, acts with loving kindness. It's sort of like sometimes, right. Sometimes exactly. Acts with loving kindness. Exactly. But you know, but it's like we are trying to, I don't know, foreground the aspects of God. And of course, this is the thing about the 13 attributes, is that the attributes that are listed in the Torah themselves, if you're reading all of them, could go either way for us. But if you're going to sort of like cut it off with the good ones, and that's sort of like, you're sort of stacking the deck. Again, it's going back to Avinu Malkeinu and Rabbi Akiva. It's, you know, Rabbi Akiva's trying to behave in a certain way that models the way God wants to behave. God, remember, God's prayer to God's self is, let my anger be conquered by my mercy. So certainly God can be angry, but we want to sort of talk about a merciful God, and that's what we're going to sort of foreground here. Okay, other things. Yeah, Ariel.
Who wrote this intro?
Who wrote the intro? Yes. He was a very popular author. His name is Anonymous, and we don't know that much about him. Right, how old is it? So it's in all of the rites of Jewish prayer, which means that it's old, but probably it doesn't show up in the Talmud. So somewhere between the end of the Talmud, let's say 6th century, and the end of the Geonim, let's say 10th century. So that's not very helpful, but it's older than a lot of things, but also kind of recent. What conclusion would you draw if you knew when exactly it was written?
I don't know if there's a direct conclusion. I think it was kind of like
okay, right. Or is it responding to something that's happening currently? Okay, yeah, David.
There seem to be, if you look at box two different introductions in which, A, what's the difference, and B, why of the two did you choose to highlight?
The El Melech. Good, right. So David's pointing out, just if you look back in the order, just in the Hebrew box on page one, the first introduction is called El Erech HaPayim. Erech HaPayim is one of the 13 attributes, like long, patient. And the next one is El Melech Yoshev. It's just the lines before the 13 attributes in that list. So the reason we're looking at El Melech Yoshev is because basically it's the one that's repeated over and over again. You only do El Arachapayim once, and El Arachapayim doesn't show up in all versions of Slichot, even though El Melech Yoshev does. So you get a lot more bang for your buck, but we could analyze that one as well, although I didn't bring it for you. Okay, yeah, a couple more. Fred.
What stood out was that it's Bochel Avonot,
mm-hmm.
and Avonot looks like Anav, which is written without a...
Oh, that's interesting.
And not to mention the Anan, which also, is not obviously not related, but looks similar. The three kind of, I don't know, they seem to rise out of the page for me somehow.
That's interesting. Right, so Avon, which means sin, and Anav, which means humble, and Anan, which means cloud, all kind of look pretty close. You could also add to that, since we've been learning in the morning, what parak are you learning in the yeshiva? That's the question that people ask Dina, but no one ever asks me. Inui, right? You're suffering, which is the same kind of root. You know, how do you play? Is there something going on here? Shira.
Yeah, I wonder if this kind of connects, because this is a puzzle, right? That's the way you're going to take the Chom. And like that, I mean, it's also interesting that it talks about God like goes down in the cloud. Like,
good.
We're using Yavrei to like also, if the Talmud's talking about that means davening, then it's like, oh, this is, I don't know, there's something like very interesting at play that these are things that both God and this person are
yes. Okay, good. Now I'm gonna put together Shira's comment and Gabi's comment. We're gonna look at some of the source things. We're not gonna look at everything here, but trust me, every line of this poem has a reference, and here, and this gets also the dating of it, the reference is not just to the Bible, but to other places in rabbinic literature. That is to say, it's aware of rabbinic literature and some of the midrashim that surround the 13 attributes. And the poet is taking those midrashim and making it into his own poetic introduction, which also is doing a close read, which the rabbis did first, on this word vayered. Vayered Adonai be'anan. What does that mean? God goes down in a cloud or through a cloud. Vayatzev imo sham. And he stood with him there. Now you're only talking pronouns. He stood with him there. Who's the he and who's the him? Right, so the characters at play are God and Moshe. So, who's in? And then Vayikra b'shem Adonai. Vayikra b'shem Adonai means, and he called in the name of God. Or, you could read it another way. Could you offer another reading of if it's translated as and he called in the name of God? Then who's the he and he called? Moshe. Could you read it another way? How? Adonai is the subject. Vayikra Adonai b'shem. God calls out with the name. And then who's speaking? Because where does the name show up? In the 13 attributes. What's the first two attributes? Adonai, Adonai, right? Okay, so maybe it's God who's calling out the word God. Vayikra Adonai b'shem. God calls out in the name. Now, let's see how this plays. Just turn over to page 3. Okay? So again, the poetic introduction introduces us, leaves us right at Exodus chapter 34, verse 5, which is in the aftermath of the golden calf. And we see here our pasuk that we've been reading, Vayera Adonai Be'anan, Vayatzev Imo Sham, Vayikra B'Shem Adonai. Adonai descended in a cloud and stood firm with him there. That is already making a decision about who the he and he is. He called in the name of Hashem, capital H. Oh boy, okay. Then, Vayavor Adonai al Panav Vayikra. How you want to translate that?
Where are you?
Sorry, page 3, box 10.
Okay.
Got me? How do you read the next verse? The way we read it is, Vayavor Adonai al Panav Vayikra, Adonai, Adonai, El Racham B'chanan. Anyone want to read another way? As we're currently reading it, God passes before his face. Who's his face? Moshe. And calls out. Who calls out? And he calls out. Now, he could be Moshe, or he could be God. Anyone want to read it to make it less ambiguous? Vayikra Adonai. Oh, that's a normal phrase. Vayavor Adonai al panav. Vayikra Adonai. Adonai el rachum b'chanun. Right? As opposed to Adonai, Adonai el rachum b'chanun. Right? Now, if you're saying it Adonai, Adonai el rachum b'chanun, that's Moshe's doing the calling. But it could be that the original biblical idea was, and God does the calling. What do you mean Moshe's going to tell God what God's attributes are? God's going to say what God's attributes are, right? I'll tell you who I am. So now, Shira noticed the other word which they're trying to figure out, which is, Vayered Adonai ba'anan. So how are you, God descends in a cloud, but you're reading it with the Midrash, which is, how are they understanding Vayered? Right, why does Vayered mean went to Davin? Yes, it's okay to review.
Would be davening, they actually went into some sort of like pit.
Yes.
And also, it like gave like very much like a, it was like very tangible what that meant to like Makim Kartika Adonai.
Right. Okay, good. Now we're getting somewhere. Vayered, God goes down. But who do we know who goes down? Yored Lifnei Ateva, who goes down before the ark, the prayer leader. Okay? This leads to the following midrash that you can see on page 3. Still on page 3. Vayavor Adonai, yeah, please.
This is a random thought, but in Rosh Hashanah, I forget where it is, Abraham. Is there any connection to Adonai?
Oh, very interesting, right? There are certain double call names in the Torah. One of them is Abraham, which happens at the Akedah, which, by the way, has its own interesting midrashic subplot, which is, why is Abraham called twice by the angel? Is it like Abraham was so ready to kill Yitzchak that he needed a second call? There's also some midrashic reading where the time has collapsed, and it's the first call to Abraham is not at the same time as the second call to Abraham, and there's something that happens in the middle, which is more tragic than the way that we have it in the Torah we have now. But anyways, there are other people who are called doubled. Anybody else who's called doubled in the Torah? Remember who else? Moshe at the burning bush, right? Important call. There's also Shmuel, when he's having his prophecy and he thinks it's Eli who's calling him. And there's one other, Yaakov, I believe. So the Midrash already tries to pick up on this and say, it's a term of endearment. I'm calling you one for endearment and the other for urgency. Okay? So it's like if I say Tony, that's different from saying Tony. If I say Tony, it's like I'm just getting your attention. But if I say Tony, either it means I'm endearing, it's like we have a relationship and I'm connecting to you by saying your name twice, and it means there's something that you have to attend to right away. Right? So now you're raising, which is amazing, because the Midrash does not add this, but if God is actually saying twice, Adonai, Adonai, and Moshe is the one who's calling it, then Moshe gets to sort of reverse that relationship up to God. If God's always doing the calling, now you're saying Moshe is the one who gets to sort of reciprocate and maybe have that term of endearment for God as well. So I like that connection with Abraham. Okay, now let's see this radical idea. Look at the bottom of page 3. I know it's radical because they tell me it's radical. They're just going to flat out tell me that this is the craziest read you've ever heard. Okay? Vayavor Adonai al panav vayikra, just quoting our verse 6 right above it on box 10. But really, what they're reading back is also verse 5, Vayer Adonai ba'anan. Amar b'yochanan, il malei mikra katuv, yefshar lo omro. This is a great phrase. Moshe Halbertal has an article on all the places where this appears. If it wasn't written in the Torah, we couldn't have dared to say this. That is to say, the Torah has said something so radical that unless the Torah said it, nobody else could have claimed it. What is it? I missed it. Tell me what it was. Okay. Milamed. This verse teaches, shenit atef HaKadosh Baruch Hu kashliach tzibor. God wraps God's self up like a prayer leader in a talit, v'her'alo lemoshe seder tefillah, and teaches Moshe how to lead the Amida. Okay? What does he say? Amarlo, kol zman she'Yisrael chotin. Whenever Israel sins, Yasu lefanai keseder azeh. You should do before me this shalosh esrei midot, this order, this listing of 13 attributes. Vani mochel lahem, and I will forgive them. Okay? That is to say, El horeita lanu lomar shalosh esrei is this midrash. God taught us how to say the 13 attributes. God taught us to say the 13 attributes with the result of when you say the 13 attributes, you will achieve mechila. Okay? You will achieve some sort of pardon. Okay. Now, let's just see how this plays out a little bit further. Okay. Let's follow this lead for one more second. So you've got the 13 attributes. Anyone want to count them? If you go back up to source 10, in page 3, what are the 13 attributes? I know there are 13. Who knows 13? I know 13. 13 are the 13 attributes. Let's just list them out. Who wants to give it a go? Okay, Jamie, go.
Adonai.
Okay, that's two. Okay, good. So El, question mark, I don't know. Maybe El is just being modified by Rachum v'Chanun. So let's put that. So Rachum is three. Let's say Chanun is four. That's five. Six. Seven. Eight. Keep going. Nine. Ten. 11. 12. So close. So what do you want to add? You want to add something else? So maybe ale. It's a little weak. You know, ale's not an attribute, it's a name. There are different ways of counting. There's multiple ways of counting it because it's totally not clear. Okay, just to see that. Like when you actually try to work your way through it, you could count in multiple ways. They're already trying to figure out what's the difference between Adonai and Adonai. Like, what's attribute one is Adonai and attribute two is Adonai? I mean, you stuck that by us. Like, it was good move. But it's like, what's the difference between Adonai and Adonai? It's the exact same word. So that's where the Gemara goes next. That's where the Talmud, again, back bottom of page three. Adonai, this is also Tony's thing. Why the doubling? Adonai, anihu kodem sheyechta adam, v'anihu leachar sheyechta adam, v'yaseh tshuva. I am God before the sin, and I am God after the sin. That is to say, there's something constant about God, God's presence, God's relationship. When I sin, I don't rupture God entirely, right? I still am here for you in some ways. Adonai before, Adonai after. The same thing they do with Abraham as well, by the way. He was always chesed from before and after. Abraham. He stays, there's something constant about him. So ironically, attribute one and attribute two is actually the same attribute with just the shifting variable as time, right? Or your action is what changed, as opposed to God's presence. Adonai is the same, but only because you changed. You changed and you did tshuva.
How is that an attribute? It's a whole God. Is it because of God's being? Or?
Yeah, so this gets to what is the attribute that Yud-Heh Vav-Heh embodies as opposed to other names of God. So what's the Yud-Heh Vav-Heh side of God? The Rachamim side, as opposed to what's the Din side of God? Elohim, right? So there's like a common rabbinic way of reading these names of God is El or Elohim is God's judgment side, and Yud-Heh Vav-Heh is God's mercy side. And that's probably related to God makes God's self known as Yud-Heh Vav-Heh. Bishmi Hashem lo nodati lahem, only to Moses does God reveal God's name as Yud-Heh Vav-Heh when God's about to redeem the Jewish people from Egypt. Right? So there's that sort of the attribute that's wrapped up in the name. But I grant you that it's not obvious. Like Rachum v'Chanun is, we're good, okay? But those are adjectives. But Adonai is a proper name. Okay. And then just we'll finish this Gemara. This is the most important Gemara for Slichot. Amar of Yehuda, Brit Kruta Lishlosh Asrei Midot, Sheinan, missing, Sheinan Chosrin Rekan is the end of it. There is Amar of Yehuda. Rav Yehuda said there is a covenant that is connected, that is written, that is engraved for the 13 Midot, that they will not be returned empty-handed. Okay? And indeed, again, stay on page 3. If you look at, let's just read this whole connection, this whole selection. Okay, so we've got page 3, source 10. Vayavor Adonai al panav vayikra. Adonai, Adonai, el rachum v'chanun. Jamie counted out for us. We're up to 13, sort of, when you get to vinake. But vinake lo yinake. You can follow in the English. He does not remit all punishment. Poked avon avor al banim v'al banei banim. He visits the sin of the fathers on the children and the children's children. Al shileshim v'al ribeim. By the way, this was the old theology. The old theology was, sin never dies. It can only be delayed. So if you want to ask for forgiveness, then it means you won't die for your sin. Your grandchild will die for your sin. All right. Who's with me with that one? That already died by the time of Ezekiel. Ish b'cheto yumat. Everyone dies for their own sin. You can't pass on your sin to your children. But that's what it means for God to have mercy. I mean, it actually takes sin quite seriously. There's no such thing as a sin that disappears. It just gets delayed. You make a sin in the world, it's going to have its impact. But it might take some time for that to roll out. Okay, that's the end of God's declaration, or maybe Moshe's, not clear. Verse 8, Vayemeher Moshe vayikat ha'aretz vayishtachu. Moshe hurries and bows down. Vayomer, im na matzati chen adonai, yelech na adonai bekirbenu, ki am k'shei orafu. Right? If I have found favor in your eyes, O Lord, yelech na adonai bekirbenu, come travel amidst us, come travel with us. Even though, I would say, even though they are a stiff-necked people. And what does God say? V'salachta la'avoneinu, Moshe continues, V'salachta la'avoneinu ulechatateinu unechaltanu, which we say in Slichot, I want you to please forgive our sins and inherit us, nechaltanu, make us your nachala, make us your inheritance. And God says, V'yomer hinei anochi koreit brit, I'm going to make a covenant with you that I'm going to follow this up with you. But this is the brit that Rabbi Yehuda sees. Oh, what's the brit that God writes? The brit is, these 13 attributes don't go back empty-handed. Right? You say these 13 attributes, and you will not be be left empty-handed. You will not be, you'll be forgiven. Okay? That's the main idea of Slichot. When you recite the 13 attributes, you are forgiven. And that's why you recite them so many times. Right? It's just, this is the secret. God gave it. God dressed up as a shliach tzibor, came down, taught Moshe what to do when you sin, and now it's all totally set. Okay? So this is amazing midrash, because again, if it wasn't written in the Torah, you wouldn't be able to say it. Although, it's a little bit unsatisfying, because it's like, why? Like, why is this some magical formula? Like, what's, how come, I don't have to do anything else? In so many ways.
I mean, especially that God already made a brie. It's not like...
Right. A new brie. Right. Right. Okay. Any other ways? Doesn't make sense?
Not a lot, but...
Okay, right. We have... Yeah, you want to add? Yeah?
It might be sort of an answer.
Please.
I mean, it's also like the context of this, like... Moshe's asking God to come back into the camp, because after Chet HaEgel, it's like he wasn't there. So in order for him to like make the brit, he needs to be able to accept Bnei Israel's sins.
In other words, the brit that's constructed after the sin of the golden calf is by definition a new brit. Because in the first brit, I mean, there was the Abraham brit, which is the old one. But the brit that's done at Sinai, everybody's doing great, right? There's no sin yet, and it's sort of like the first naivete. Everybody's on the level, and God's going to create a covenant with this people that is ready to receive, Naaseh v'nishma. And then Moshe goes up and gets the rest of the laws, and people in the first, did I say this here? My friend who said that the golden calf is the first DIY Jewish community. It's like, you know, you leave them alone for 10 seconds, okay? And yeah, they're like bowing down to a cow. So it has to like, the new brit needs to undo the old brit. The old brit was with an imagined people who don't sin. But the new brit is one of like real people who, given any moment to sin, would sin. And nevertheless, you can still make a covenant with them. Adonai, Adonai. Adonai before the sin, and Adonai after the sin when people do tshuva. That is a sort of a new world. Yeah,
got it. I have a question.
Yeah.
So the Midrash kind of goes the aspect that you mentioned a while ago with the other way of reading the Adonai, Adonai, by giving one Adonai to the first part of the sentence, saying that it was Hashem who proclaimed it. Who proclaimed Adonai, God, etc. But it, so, do they have grammatical equivalents, or like, why did we go with one over the other? Does it just not make as much sense?
Yeah. If you were going to read it straight up, you wouldn't necessarily read it the way they end up reading it. By the way, the other grammatical thing they change is they cut off in the middle of a phrase. The phrase is "Vinake lo yinake." God does not stop, does not acquit, does not clean. Linakot. But actually, they stop it right there. And so they're willing to play with the grammar to sort of get their point. Actually, I think we often attribute that to the rabbis. Like the bold rabbi move is to take the 13 attributes and erase all the part of the attributes that are the negative parts, like visiting sin on children and things like that. And we'll just stop it. And God acquits everybody. And that's sort of like the God I want to have on Yom Kippur. But it's actually, it goes way before the rabbis. I just wanted to show you this because I thought it was amazing when you actually take your time to look at it. If you flip over to page 7. Look at page 7. Again, we're spending time on the 13 attributes because this is the core part of Slichot. So, and I brought to you in Hebrew because you actually don't need the English so much to see it. You can just see how this works. On the right-hand column of this many columns, these are all the places where God's attributes show up in Tanakh as a list of attributes, okay? The longest one is the one that we're looking at, all the way to the right. Okay, that's the one that we read. Now, what you'll see is the one word that doesn't appear again, I mean, the one that shows up all the time, what do you got, what's your sort of your main theme? If I was going to say to you, across the Bible, what are God's attributes? According to this chart, yeah, Erech Apayim and Rav Chesed is almost in everyone, not in Nahum. I mean, Erech Apayim is there, right? And then you've got a pretty good showing for Rachum and Chanun. Okay, so Rachum means merciful. Chanun means grace, giving you grace. Erech Apayim, long patient, and Rav Chesed, and great in love. What's the one that's missing? Ve'emet. Now, what's amazing here is that we saw already in Unatana Tokef, Chesed and Emet are having a battle, right? Chesed and Emet are enemies of each other. And you can see, what's amazing is there is a retelling of the story of the golden calf in Nehemiah. Okay, so that's the third one from the end here. Nehemiah Perek Tet. Okay? Nehemiah, way after the exile. Eloah Selichot, Chanun Verachum, Erech Apayim Verav Chesed, is when they retell the story of the golden calf. That is to say, already in Nehemiah, they are editing God's attributes to wipe out Emet, visiting sin upon the third and fourth generation. It's like, it's gone. God is just all good. Okay? So it's the rabbis are just sort of playing off what's already been happening in the Bible, which is the 13 attributes, the punishing side of the 13 attributes, that is to say, attributes 14, 15, and 16, are not kept in the Bible itself, right? The Bible itself is editing God to only be chesed and not be emet. And who is the person who is really ticked off by this in the Bible? Yonah, right? Remember the story of Jonah? If you don't remember, we'll read it on Yom Kippur afternoon. Jonah who says, I don't want to go off and tell the people of Nineveh that you're all going to be saved, you're all going to be destroyed, because I know you, God. You're gonna flip this around. You're going to be Rav Chesed, and you're going to forgive them. And by the way, totally right. Do you remember what Yonah's name is? Yonah ben Amittai. He is Jonah, the son of truth. By the way, he shows up not just in the book of Yonah, but if you turn over to page 8, he's actually like a prophet that shows up right there in 2 Kings as Yonah ben Amittai, Jonah son of truth. So Jonah is sort of the representative of the truth side. He's even more true than God in that story, right? Jonah wants everybody to be punished exactly as they deserve. Nineveh, I want you to go down. I'm not going to be a, this is his excuse anyways, why he runs away. I'm not going to prophesy against you because I know how this is going to end. If it was up to me, Jonah, I would have you all, you know, pay for your sins. But God isn't like that, right? So Jonah has truth in him, but God only has chesed at that point. Yeah.
So why would there be, so if they start to, they're starting to edit the attributes of God because maybe to make it a little more friendly, why would they have an entire story of like a reaction to that or something? Why would you?
Yeah, well, meaning why would Jonah, why would the book, I think, well, God teaches Jonah a lesson. Remember, at the end, Jonah has this this plant that he's so, you know, in love with because it's giving him some shade, and then God destroys the plant, and Jonah's all upset, and God says, you're upset about the plant, but you're not upset about the tens of thousands of people and animal that would have died in the city if you had just kept your you know, your focus. That is to say, God teaches Jonah that the world doesn't survive on Emmet. Yonah ben Amittai is not of this world. The world has to live on chesed. And that's basically the, even though Jonah's like, but that's not fair. But it is actually the way things are going to operate if anyone's going to survive. By the way, remember the Midrashic read of that story of Nineveh, just might as well say it. Who is the king of Nineveh according to the Midrash? You know?
Wasn't it Paro?
Paro, okay? Because Paro, Pharaoh, never explicitly dies in Exodus. I mean, it seems like he's dead, but it doesn't say Vayamot Paro, Vayam, God, you know, or God killed Pharaoh. It doesn't say that. So the Midrash has Paro running off to Nineveh, taking over as king, and getting a second chance, and actually doing it. Like, finally learns his lesson and does tshuva. Because remember, in the story of Jonah, it's not just the people, but also the king gets off his throne and sackcloth and ashes and the whole thing. Right? So imagine if you're like, you're Jonah. You're Jewish, and you know what Paro did to your people. Killed hundreds, thousands of Jewish babies, right? And you're going to say, oh, you're going to have mercy on him? I mean, that's an incredibly daring Midrashic read of that story. It's already pretty daring, right? You know, Nineveh's, again, on Yom Kippur, the model of tshuva is a huge city of non-Jews. Like, those guys get it much better than we do. They're the ones we're supposed to learn from. And who's at their head? Paro. That's an interesting Yom Kippur, right? Paro's teaching me how to do tshuva. Yeah?
Yeah, sometimes I definitely think that part of like teaching the 13 attributes is also like just creating a God that would act that way. And it's like, oh, well, you want to like be in a relationship with God and believe in a God who does these things, and that's why we're having this day of Yom Kippur so we can daven and that like that God can listen to us. And then I also wonder maybe, like, part of that is, like, I feel like usually I'm, like, kind of, like, scared to, like, say that, like, oh, like, we're creating a God, because that, like, feels almost, like heretical to be like, oh, no, like, we create God, and maybe that's also why that's such an important part of, like, teshuvah, but it also feels kind of like a bodhisattva or something. I don't know. Like, I'm actually, like, wondering.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a good point, which is to say, I'm not sure why I would use the language of creating God, but maybe foregrounding a certain part of God. That's what I like. What I like about that midrash we saw last time, which is God prays about God's own will. God has two sides, but God wants the side of mercy to win, and we also want the side of mercy in ourselves and in God to win. And I think that's part of Again, less of creation, but more of the foregrounding. I mean, if we go back to our formula, if you go back to El Melech Yoshev, just so we can see this, look back on page one, we say, I mean, Jonathan, we're talking about this already, El Melech Yoshev al Kisei Rachamim, Midnaheg b'chasidut. We've got a God who sits on the seat of Rachamim, of mercy, and who behaves with chesed. Okay? So whether it's creating or really just foregrounding, let's just see what that means, okay? So, turn over to page two. We're going to unpack El Melech Yoshev al Kisei Rachamim. Why does God sit on a throne of mercy? This is sort of like top three midrashim of Rosh Hashanah. You have this verse in Psalm 47, Allah Elohim bitrua Adonai b'kol shofar. God, Elohim, rises with the trua blast, yud hei vav hei with the kol of the sound of the shofar. Now we already saw, what's the difference between the first half and the second half of the verse? Elohim versus Adonai. What's my Elohim? Din, right, is my judgment, harsh, truth God. But by the end of the verse, we've already got Yud Hei Vav Hei, the merciful God. So the Midrash reads this and says, right on the next source, number 5, Yehuda bar Nachmani b'shem Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish patach. So we have this interpretation of the verse. Allah Elohim b'tru'a Adonai b'kol shofar, what we just read. K'sha'kadosh baruch hu oleh le'shev al kisei hadin b'rosh hashanah, l'din hu ola. God rises to sit on the seat of judgment. It's judgment day. That's what the verse says when it says God goes up. That is to say, the judging God goes up. Bitrua, yom trua. V'kevan she'Yisrael notlin shofrotein v'tokin. But when Israel blows the shofar, cries out, whatever sort of emotional metaphor you want to build in there, miyad Adonai b'kol shofar. Ah, now it's yud hei vav hei. Upon hearing the sound of the shofar, to say the merciful God. Ma kadosh baruch hu oseh. What does God do? Omid mi kisei adin v'yoshev al kisei rachamim. So El Melech yoshev al kisei rachamim means, it's like an ellipsis where God was on the kisei of din, but now I've gotten God, or God has gotten God's self through our help or whatever, to move to the seat of mercy. Okay, so we're foregrounding a merciful God. And that's umitmalei alehem rachamim, and is filled with mercy for them. Ve'ofech lehem midat adin lemidat rachamim, and God's midah, God's attribute of din, emet, actually gets turned into rachamim. Eimatai, when on Rosh Hashanah, v'chodesh hashvi becha v'chodesh 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 midrash. Okay. Now the chesed thing is, I think, also interesting. If you see, just saying on page 2, so we have in our formula, in our introduction, El Melech Yoshev al Kisei Rachamim, we now have that, God who sits on the throne of mercy. Midnaheg b'chasidut, who behaves with chesed. What's that talking about? Im chasid tit chasad, we have this somewhat esoteric fragment of a verse in Psalm 18. With the chasid, you should do chesed. So Rabbi Nechemiah explains the verse as relating to Moshe Rabbeinu. B'sha'a sheba b'chasidut im HaKadosh Baruch Hu, af HaKadosh Baruch Hu b'yimo b'chasidut. What does it mean for God to behave with chesed? It means when God is approached with chesed, God behaves in chesed. Okay? That is to say, getting back to Rabbi Akiva, if Rabbi Akiva is the one who is leading the davening, then Rabbi Akiva is modeling the way that we want God to behave. Similarly, in this midrash, when Moshe behaves with God in chesed, then God behaves to Moshe with chesed. What do you mean? How could Moshe behave with chesed to God? What would it look like for Moshe to love or to act with chesed towards God? So the Midrash gives one suggestion. Eimatai ba'imo b'chasidut. When did Moshe approach God with chasidut, with love? B'sha'a she'amar lo madua lo yivar asneh. I love this. When was Moses acting to God with chesed? When Moses asks a question of the burning bush and says, why is this bush burning but not being eaten up? That is to say, to act toward God with chesed is to ask a question or to notice something or to pay attention, right? Moses is drawn aside, is by Asar Lirod, right? He turns aside to look. What it means to behave in chesed. How do you love God? You notice things, you ask questions, and you don't take the world as like, oh yeah, that's just this thing that I walk through without paying attention, right? And when you pay attention, you're behaving with chesed, God is going to come and behave towards you with chesed. Mitnaheg b'chasidut. El melech yoshev al kisei rachamim. God's already sitting on the throne of mercy. Mitnaheg b'chasidut. Because of my actions of relating to God with chesed, question, wonder, then God's going to come and relate to me with chesed. Then you have this Mochel Avon Olamo, who forgives the sins of his nation. We saw that in the Midrash of God wrapping it in a talit. Ma'avir Rishon Rishon. I love this one. What does Ma'avir Rishon Rishon mean? Translated here as removes their sin one by one. Literally passes over one, or first. Okay? So the Talmud somewhat unhelpfully tells us, bottom of page 2, Tana de Rabbi Yishmael, school of Rabbi Yishmael says, Ma'avir Rishon Rishon, v'chein hi amida. This is the attribute of God. But it doesn't say what it means here. So we got to go to our commentators, Rashi. Rashi tells us, what is Ma'avir Rishon Rishon? So look at the top of page 3. Avon, shebarishonim habaim letitam lekaf, ma'aviro b'shomto. You know how it's a scale, it's a balance, okay? And you're piling up the sins on one side and the good deeds on the other side. So ma'avir rishon rishon means, on the sin side, you know what? You get a freebie, right? God pulls out the first sin, is taken off the scale, right? Because who could really be responsible for that sin that you did? Come on. It was like right after Yom Kippur, you were jostling at the break fast or something like that, right? So God just takes out that ma'avir rishon rishon, removes that one from the scale. Like if you could go back over last year and say, you know what? I want this thing that I did to just not ever be. Like if I just give myself one freebie, I don't know, what would you choose, right? Okay, so we've got ma'avir rishon rishon. El melech hashev al kitzei rachamim. Midnaheg b'chassidut. Mochel avanot amo. Ma'avir rishon rishon. And then, marbe michila al chataim, slicha al poshim. We have all this forgiveness language. Lo chira atam tigmol. And then we have El Horeta Lana Lamar Shalosh Esrei, Zechor Lana Yom Brit Shalosh Esrei. God, who taught us to say this 13 attributes. I think more, Marian, about your idea of Basar V'Ruach as opposed to Basar V'Dam. Zechor Lana Yom Brit Shalosh Esrei. Remember us today, this Brit Shalosh Esrei, this Brit that Rav Yehuda said you cut with us, the 13 attributes. Brit, that whenever we say it, will be returned not empty-handed. Kimosha datalana mikedem, just like you taught Moses of old, and now we quote the verse. Okay? And that's the whole introduction, right? And then we say the quote from Adonai, Adonai El Rachum Mechanu. Okay? So what we've done is, we've got the introduction to the Shlosh Ser Midot, we've got the Shlosh Ser Midot themselves, okay? God teaching us to say these Shlosh Ser Midot, the way in which the 13 attributes come other times in the Bible, but in all other times except for one place in Psalms, are getting rid of the word emet. And even when Jonah, son of truth, wants to bring back emet into the picture, God says, no, I'm going to act just with chesed, and you're going to have to deal with it. Because you love this plant, and I love people much more than you even could love this plant. Okay? That's part of what we're getting at here. Now, the one last thing I want to end with is, why is the sin of the golden calf the main story of Yom Kippur that is repeated over and over again in Slichot? What is it about the sin of the golden calf? Of all the sins, we could pick a lot of sins. The sin of the spies, I said, already comes in one other place in Slichot. Probably was added later, but that, don't mean to deny it. That was a big sin of the spies. But sin of the golden calf as sort of like the core, if you think of Yom Kippur as a story, okay? The story of Yom Kippur is the sin of the golden calf. It's trying to recover from the sin of the golden calf. So why is it that the sin of the golden calf is the narrative that stands behind Yom Kippur? What about that sin is something that could sort of drive the narrative of this whole tshuva day? Yeah.
I guess the golden calf of the Tiasha and Moshe for a few days, to know what to do, so they created their own God in this, I guess, in a way, you know, people always teach us for that because it's kind of affirming God as God is meant to be.
Ah, okay, right. So this, you're saying the quality of the tshuva for the sin of the golden calf is actually affirming God's presence and the nature of God as we want God to be, as opposed to giving loyalty somewhere else. So it's like a perfect sort of undoing of the sin. Good. Okay. Yeah.
after Tula was done for that, there was sort of a full restoration, like a second set of tablets were given. It wasn't just like, okay, I forgive you, and we're going to sort of give you back the thing that was lost in the act of that sin.
Ah, good, right. If you remember, and Ethan spoke about this one morning, I think in my house, that the set of 40-day cycles that we're working through end up with the Yom Kippur being the day that Moshe comes down with the second set of tablets, right? If you're counting from the first set of tablets being broken on the 17th of Tammuz, and then you're working your way through the cycle to Yom Kippur, by the time you get to Yom Kippur, you've made it through the last 40-day cycle, which begins the first of Elul. We start blowing the shofar now. And that's the one where at the end of that 40-day cycle, you're coming down with the Luchot. So Yom Kippur is not only the narrative of the golden calf, it's the sort of happy end of that story where you get that second shot of the Luchot. Which, by the way, the first one, Asher Shibart, is also the rabbinic midrash of God congratulates Moshe for breaking the first tablets, Yasher Koach Sheshibarta, which is something to do with that first go-round couldn't really last. People don't really behave the way they behaved at Mount Sinai, where they're constantly saying, yeah, I'll do things before I hear them, and I'm not going to sin, and I'm perfectly pure. That's like a dust kind of breed. It's good that you broke that breed. The real breed is the one with the people who actually have gone through some sort of complete disloyalty. You were going to add? Oh, yeah.
I was thinking kind of along the lines of the Midrash of Chesed, that like the act of the golden calf was the ultimate. Well, I see Moshe noticing the burning bush and asking the questions, like noticing Hashem, or like noticing something out of the ordinary, refusal to notice. They're like, no, we're going to make our own thing. That's what we're going to call Hashem instead of like noticing that Hashem is like ready.
Ready, right.
And then doing teshuva for that is like accepting Hashem for the truth or something like that.
Yeah, I think it's also part of the impetus of the, and then their excuse for the golden calf is, we didn't know where Moshe went. Like, what did you expect? We thought it was over, right? So there's some, like, it is a core uncertainty that gives rise to the golden calf. You know, I don't know if this is actually anything anymore. I thought I heard all that sound and light, but actually nothing's been going on for a long time. So that's also sort of, in what way is Yom Kippur sort of an acknowledgement of the uncertainty that we live in? Deep, deep, like, you know, real existential uncertainty, and trying to hold off the desire to make something visible and certain, when really what's real is the uncertainty. What's fake is the statue. Yeah, Tony.
Sometimes you go back to the Adonai, Adonai, because his whole definition is that before and after, and I was thinking, where is he during? God during, and you have golden calf appears in that interstitial period.
Good. Oh, that's interesting. If there's a before and an after, but there's actually a time that's neither before nor after, which is when they sort of losing that that faith and are unwilling to hang out in that uncertainty of they knew God before and they have God after, but there's that the scary liminal space that gives rise to the calf, which is like that is the scariest thing. I mean, if you've in a much much less serious experience of this, trying to leave the house with children. Nobody wants to cross that threshold. They'll do anything. They'll pee on the floor if they want to, right? Just to stay. But it's like the uncertainty of crossing. And that's, you know, that is so much of what we're about to go into. Like we are in the 10 days now is like, the, you know, we got one more week before Moshe actually comes down off the mountain. We're terrified. It's a terrifying, we haven't crossed yet, you know? It's very hard. Josh, what are you saying?
There are parts of the group here, but one thing that I really struck me when we were starting to look at before, a way that it sort of shifts from a day in which the Kohanim are sort of making up for the sake of, I always say that time, it's a long set of names.
Nadav and Abihu.
Thank you. And that they're sort of like the beginning of the parakim that talks about Yom Kippur is all a Kohen-based thing, sort of purifying the temple, and there's sort of this end thing that's like, oh, and by the way, the people are sort of involved in this thing over here.
Uh-huh.
And I think part of the narrative that happens around Yom Kippur is kind of shifting the weight around. But one of the things about putting it in this is that in terms of sort of shifting the paradigm of how you view Yom Kippur from this very Kohen-centered activity, and we're just sort of like there, and it's not exactly clear like how important what we're doing is. On the one hand, it really shifts it to being about a communal responsibility and like this like B'nai Israel sort of facet, but it still doesn't forget to have an aspect of the mistake of Aharon and his children, because Aharon is the reason why we sort of like had
Interesting, right. Aharon is implicated in the golden calf itself. He's the one who sort of lets it happen.
In other words, it allows the reframing to happen
without letting go of the priestly element to it. Yeah, that's really interesting. Right, because the morning Torah reading that we do is that first is right. Yeah, exactly. Right, chapter 16 of Leviticus, which is the story of the priestly Yom Kippur, which is we better clean the temple. It's filled with sin, as opposed to people had this experience that they need to reflect on and ask forgiveness for. But just saying it brings the people back in this framing. Shira.
Yeah, I guess my mind is kind of going in two ways. So I think in one instance, it's like, this place, like, I listened to the golden calf was like this like really bad thing, and we always talk about it. It's like, oh, if God can like forgive us then, and then like God show us this chesed now. And then also, I'm wondering, this morning we were talking about the way that like kapara can also mean like covering, and in that
kapara
sense, like the chleita egel can also, it's like almost this like original sin kind of the Jewish people and of B'nai Israel, and it's like Yom Kippur, it's really like, it's not like, we don't like really nullify like what we've done, but it's this like constant like covering up and like atoning for and coming back and like asking God for this chesed again.
Mm.
And then I'm also wondering if we're going along the lines of if chesed like within Midrash Tehillim is also noticing. So in some ways, it's if the people are saying, God, we notice all these things about you, like we're also demonstrating this chesed. So like, please show chesed on us too.
Uh-huh. Right. The noticing. Right. Because you can, again, you could notice. You could notice the absence. You could notice the total existential scariness of what it means to be alive, and lead you to do things to try to gain control and make things concrete and more certain, and instead to notice things like the burning bush without, I don't know, by asking a question as opposed to doing an action. Maybe that's also part of the stance of Yom Kippur, is to ask some questions as opposed to like rushing to solutions. Just take a moment and let's ask some deep questions here. I think part of it, sort of Josh is reminding me also of like, you know, part of the idea of cleaning the temple on Yom Kippur was for an end result, which was to allow the priest to go inside to the Holy of Holies and pronounce God's name, which is only able to be done when all the sin is cleared. And I think that's also sort of what I take away from the sin being the golden calf sin. Because ironically, after the sin of the golden calf, you have the, and before the 13 attributes, you have Exodus 33, which is one of the strangest chapters in the Torah, but is the chapter that is about Moshe begging God to have a deeper relationship and encounter. That's what Moshe says to God, will you please show me, Hareini na et kavodecha, please show me your glory. And God sort of seemingly compromises and says, stand in the rock and I'll pass before you. And Moshe has the most intense experience of God's presence that Moshe has until maybe God, Moshe dies, which is also an aspect of Yom Kippur, sort of the death encounter. But sort of, I find myself wondering, what is it about the sin of the golden calf that was so intense and so core to betrayal that the makeup for that is the most intense encounter that human has with God. And that's also part of how Yom Kippur could be experienced. In other words, you do tshuva for all the intense wrongs, and then you have this moment of deep one-on-one encounter that you can only experience having done that tshuva. Like the day that you walk into the Holy of Holies could only be the day when you've gone through that intense experience of undoing all the wrong or asking forgiveness for all the wrongs. This is why I think, I'm not totally sure about this, but I think it has something to do with also the idea of Yom Kippur being the love day. You know, in addition to, there were 2 days a year when the unmarrieds of Israel would dress in white and go out to the field and pair off. And one of them was Tu B'Av, the 15th day of Av, and the other was Yom Kippur afternoon, and here you were napping, right? Right? It's like Yom Kippur afternoon meets the matzah ball, you know? But it's like, you know, it's like, what is it about Yom Kippur? I mean, literally, that was like what they were saying. It's like they would all dress in white. It's like, why do we dress in white in Yom Kippur? We look good in white. Let's all, you know, let's all head out to the fields and encounter our beloved. Like, why on Yom Kippur is that the day when they imagine that that encounter is happening? I think it's a reflection of the encounter that we're all trying to have with God in Shul. So if you think of Yom Kippur as sort of this two-step process, where step one is you have the tshuva and the intensity of the sin that you're recounting and acknowledging and asking forgiveness for, even though we don't deserve it, and there's chesed. And then having achieved that, right, then you have the avodah section of Yom Kippur and Mare Kohen, and you can, like, you know, encounter God's presence on Yom Kippur, and you prostrate before God only on Yom Kippur, because that's the only day when you can get that close to God. How much of closeness is being driven by the post-tshuva sort of relation building that you can't have without that sin and its makeup? That also gives rise to humans themselves coupling off with each other by the afternoon. Meaning the afternoon of Yom Kippur is like kind of, like, why, have you ever been to a Yom Kippur service where they dance at the end? You know, like Lashana Haba, you're dancing at the end of Yom Kippur. You know, it's like, because Yom Kippur also is a happy day. First of all, you made it through. There's something to that. Like, if the day is itself atonement, you made it through the day. That counts for a lot. But also, you've had this intense encounter, right, that you could only have once you do that tshuva, which I think, again, calls on the cycle of the golden calf sin and the restoration of the relationship that is deeper and more serious than it ever was in that first naivete at Mount Sinai, which isn't really human. It's only the second time around, the second luchot, that you can really build that that real relationship. Okay, we're going to stop here. Last session on Wednesday, vidui, and we're going to go roaring into Yom Kippur.